Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of the fifth session from our Becoming Buddha Foundations of Mindfulness and Meditation Spring Retreat at One Dharma Center on May 18, 2018. My talk and our Sangha discussion is on the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta and the Anattalakkhana Suttas. The Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta is the Buddha's very first teaching, where he established developing profound understanding of Four Noble Truths as a context and purpose of his Dhamma. Everything the Buddha would teach during his 45-year teaching career was taught in the context of the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta and informed by the Paticca-samuppada Sutta, the primary sutta on dependent origination. The Anattalakkhana Sutta is the second teaching of an awakened human being, where the Buddha teaches how to recognize and abandon selfing or eye-making as the ultimate goal of the Dhamma, to empty oneself of self-referential wrong views rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. These first two suttas referred to here and the following fire discourse are considered the cardinal discourses, or the three most primary and important suttas, and the singular focus of insight, vipassana, gaining insight into three marks of existence. It can be seen that Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta speaks to impermanence and ending all wrong views, and the Anattalakkhana Sutta explains how self-referential views arise in ignorance of Four Noble Truths, which forms the basis for developing attachments to impermanent objects, events, views, and ideas. The following discourse, the fire discourse, speaks to the third mark of existence of dukkha arising from the passion for continued self-establishment. Information on our future retreats is available at becoming-buddha.com, and all of these talks are based on the suttas included in my book, Becoming Buddha, Becoming Awakened. If you find benefit from this recording, and to support future recordings, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
As Mary just said, or was it Liz? I get used. It's an auspicious day. And that leads to something. I was just looking at our schedule, and by the time we leave on Sunday, we will have, in a rather in-depth way, examined a dozen suttas.
Wow.
It feels like it.
Yeah. I was going to ask you, does it feel like it?
Yeah,
it feels like it.
That's pretty remarkable. But I'm going for the record, as I said.
Yeah.
And I may introduce one more tonight before, depends where we get to today. Either
the Buddha spoke up world record.
I'm thinking of the Bhadakarada or the Vitakasanthana Sutta, because I think they'll fit, and if there seems like there's time and it'll be graceful enough, one of those we'll use those too. And so today is a focus on the Buddha's first three discourses, the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, the Anattalakkhana Sutta, and the Fire Discourse. And those three suttas, I probably shouldn't be giving the introduction now because I'm going to do it again, but those three suttas, in a very direct way, teach to the three marks of existence. The Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta is impermanence, the Anattalakkhana Sutta is a not self-characteristic, and the Fire Discourse is dukkha. And so the Buddha used those opportunities to teach to establish the foundation of the Dhamma again, so that what would follow would be in that context, much like we're doing here. And so those of you that have been on retreat before, which is everybody except David and Becky, those suttas are familiar to you, but again, you're going to see them in a context that you've never had before, because this is all new to you, just as it's all new to me. We're not the same people we were yesterday or at the last retreat. A question now, because you took so long to get here, I don't get no respect, no respect. I just want to do that. Love Rodney. Should we forego this half-hour meditation? Again, make it 10 minutes, and Matt's going to be leading another half-hour meditation this afternoon, and we will do a half-hour meditation tonight. So is it okay or preferable that we just begin with a 10-minute meditation, or should we keep to the...
If we keep to the half-hour sit, can we just go a little bit closer to lunch? Or?
Well, we would then. We would probably be pushing right up against 12 o'clock.
That sounds good to me.
Okay, so let's set our...
Do a half an hour.
Yes.
Okay.
Let's set our mindfulness to the fore and meditate. What a committed sangha. Wondering how, what the response. And I'm glad that you decided to meditate, but it would have been fine. And really the only reason I ask is I'm very conscious of putting too much into this, and making it overwhelming. But you're hanging with me, so thank you. Our meditation session has been edited out. Guided Shamatha Vipassana meditations of various lengths are available at becoming-buddha.com. The Buddha cautioned about sitting in high chairs and high seats and high beds. I'm just kidding.
First time I
make yourself comfortable, please.
Yeah.
Really, Kevin? I'm sorry. I didn't.
It's all right.
I'm not going to teach until you get back in that comfortable position. No, you do whatever you want.
I'll keep you back
then. Really, I'm sorry, Kevin.
No.
Is everybody's needs being met?
So back
except for Kevin's foot story.
Just trying it out. Back feels fun.
Not me, not mine.
You're supposed to say what? You're supposed to say what needs.
Yeah.
Well, if you have any, you can ask me or Matt or Lorna or David or Mary or Laura or Kevin or Becky. Or Liz, or Ron, or Jen. So this is the very first teaching. I went over this just a few weeks ago in Cross River Meditation Center. Of course, the reason why I'm doing it now is the context. It's important to at least review it on retreat. And the setting is that this is a few weeks after the Buddha's awakening. He has carefully considered how to teach what he's learned now, what he learned through that process that we studied in the Nagara Sutta. And so the Buddha has gotten up off his meditation cushion and has decided to start his ministry, if you want to call it that, his teaching career. And so he's taking a walk to see who anybody's interested in what he has to say. And what you know it, the first people that he comes across are the five buddies that he was wandering around northern India all those years, studying and practicing these very severe ascetic practices. And so these his five buddies are now convinced that the Buddha is lost to the world. He's starting to eat what they classified as luxurious food and living a luxurious lifestyle. He started eating gruel to get his strength back, and he started to sleeping on leaves and branches for a little bit more comfort. They were so used to the ascetic practices that they thought, he's gone. Until they saw the Buddha walking down the road, and they said, we are going to shun him. We're not going to have anything to do with him, until they recognized that because of his countenance that he had achieved the goal that they were all looking for. The Buddha was staying at Varanasi, which is where he awakened. There he addressed a group of five friends from his travels, all seeking understanding. There are these two extremes that are not to be indulged in by one who has gone forth seeking understanding. Which two? That extreme that is devoted to sensual pleasure with reference to sensual objects. This extreme is base, vulgar, common, ignoble, unprofitable. Also, the extreme that is devoted to self-affliction and self-denial. This extreme is painful, ignoble, unprofitable. Avoiding both of these extremes, the middle way is realized by the Tathagata. A rightly self-awakened, he's talking about himself, obviously, a rightly self-awakened one that produces vision and knowledge and develops a calm mind. How does the Buddha know the extremes? Because he's lived both of them. He had, from the time he was born, he was showered with complete, sent anything he wanted from the time he was born, he was given, and even more so, with the King Suddhodana's understanding that if I can just If I can just get him addicted to wealth and power, he'll never want to leave the Sangha. Of course, when the Buddha was born, he was told by two wise men, not three, that your son will either be a great spiritual leader or a great political leader. He'll follow in his footsteps or he will leave and become part of the world. And of course, the father wanted to keep him in, so he thought that the best way to do that is to really literally get him addicted to wealth and power. It didn't work, thankfully. And so the Buddha then spent the next 6 years of his life practicing mostly severe ascetic practices, where it said, the Buddha describes it himself, that he was living on a grain of rice or one bean a day, and he became so emaciated that he could touch his spine through touching his belly. And I won't get into the whole story, but eventually he passed out from malnutrition and exhaustion, and a young girl, Sujata, nursed him back to health, giving him some gruel. And so here we are. And the reason why I said that is through our life experience that we gain insight also, and we have the proper mindset. This middle way develops direct knowledge and self-awakening. This middle way develops unbinding. And what is the middle way that produces vision, produces knowledge, and develops a calm mind, a path to direct knowledge, to self-awakening, to unbinding? Precisely this noble eightfold path. Right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right mindfulness, and right meditation. This is the middle way that produces vision, produces knowledge, and develops a calm mind. The Buddha stating also what the goal of his Dhamma is. Vision, knowledge, and a calm mind. A path to direct knowledge, to self-awakening, to unbinding. Now this, friends, is the noble truth of stress. Birth is stressful. Aging is stressful. Death is stressful. Sorrow, regret, pain, distress, and despair are stressful. Association with the undesired is stressful. Separation from what is desired is stressful. Not getting what is wanted is stressful. And we all know that, don't we? In fact, even that part about associating with the unwise or associating with people that are stuck in self-referential views, it's stressful, isn't it? Even when we're still stuck in self-referential views. The Buddha is giving an initial, though complete, teaching on how to practice the Dhamma, associate with the wise. It's not stressful. And you know that from associating with me. I think sometimes I create stress still. And he always concludes that statement consistently throughout his teaching career from the very first teaching. In short, the five clinging aggregates are stressful. And notice how all these teachings that we've been discussing in some way point us back to understanding the five clinging aggregates, the personal experience of suffering.
Can you say at this point what the five clinging aggregates are so that we can...
Yes. I haven't done that yet.
Well,
can
you do it now?
I will. No, I was just thinking, did I do it yet? Form, feeling, perceptions, mental fabrications, and consciousness. And we know that consciousness is ongoing thinking, ruminant ignorance. And if we look at ourselves with a calm and peaceful mind, or as much as we can generate in the moment, we can see those aggregates very clearly in ourselves. We describe ourselves as form. We describe ourselves as feelings, don't we? I'm feeling good. I'm feeling good. I'm feeling bad. I'm having a good day. I'm having a good week. I'm having a bad week. We describe ourselves often how we see things. This is how I see it. One of the phrases that really kind of drives me a little bit, still gets me going, is when somebody says to someone else, this is what I hear you saying. Well, that's a complete dismissal of what that person is saying, isn't it? And you're saying, this is my perception. And it's rooted in the next fabrication, mental fabrications or assumptions. And again, that ongoing consciousness. So we can see this in ourselves, can't we? Very readily. And so we can see the arising and the passing away of the aggregates through a direct experience of them. Is that clear? And that we've all had that experience. We're gaining the knowledge of five clinging aggregates, of our own personal experience of suffering. Thank you for asking, Liz. And this, friends, is a noble truth of the origination of stress, the craving that makes for further becoming. Further becoming what? Further becoming ignorant. Craving accompanied by passion and delight, clinging now here and now there, craving for sensual pleasure, craving for becoming, and craving for non-becoming, meaning anything other than what a true self is. And this, friends, is a noble truth of the cessation of stress. The remainderless fading and cessation, the renunciation, the relinquishment, the release, the letting go of that very craving. And this, friends, is a noble truth of the way of practice leading to the cessation of stress, precisely this noble eightfold path. Right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right mindfulness, and right meditation. I was mentioning to Jen yesterday that how this is first an intellectual experience. That's how human beings learn. And then if it's something that we can actually have a direct experience of it, we do so. When I first came across the Eightfold Path, it took me quite a while. And I wish I had written down when I first came across it and when I could just memorize it, just pull from memory what the eight were. Now, these are simple things. And if you gave most human beings with a reasonable mind a list of eight things, cat, pillow, truck, you know, washing machine, the president, we'd be able to memorize those in just a few repetitions in our own mind, couldn't we? Anybody could. I could. But for some reason, because even though these are simple and direct, there's a natural inherent aversion to even accepting these on an intellectual level. It challenges our own ignorance. And so I first had to go through that process of just memorizing what these are. I think it was David was talking about, maybe not but somebody, that how you, Frank Stock talks about this often too, how he reviews, and this is from the very beginning he started doing this, in his meditation when he's done, he reviews the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path, just to bring it into his consciousness, just to initially memorize it, and then we can have an experience of it, we can recognize it. Vision arose, insight arose, discernment arose, illumination arose within me with regards to things never heard before. Where do we hear that before?
Nagarasutta.
This is the noble truth of stress. Vision arose, discernment, I should read that in a different way. Vision arose, insight arose, discernment arose, knowledge arose, illumination arose within me with regards to things never heard before. This is the noble truth of stress. It was never heard before. The Buddha, upon his awakening, is now introducing this. Think about the momentous and auspicious time. This is the very first teaching that he's giving on this. And he's telling these folks, you've never heard this before. With all the studies and all the travels over the 6 years, this is something unique. Listen to this. Vision arose, insight arose, discernment arose, knowledge arose, illumination arose within me with regards to things never heard before, another thing that's never been heard before. The noble truth of stress is to be comprehended. Now he's describing how to develop understanding, to accept that dukkha occurs, and then to understand stress, to comprehend it. When the Buddha describes awakened right view, he says that that view is a view that has a penetrative understanding of stress. Stress has been comprehended. Vision arose, insight arose, discernment arose, knowledge arose, illumination arose within me, an important line, with regards to things never heard before, the noble truth of stress has been comprehended. The task is to comprehend it. Awakening is actually achieving that task. The noble truth of stress has been comprehended. Vision arose, insight arose, discernment arose, knowledge arose, illumination arose within me with regards to things never heard before. This is a noble truth of the origination of stress. This noble truth of the origination of stress is to be abandoned. This noble truth of the origination of stress has been abandoned. Vision arose, insight arose, discernment arose, knowledge arose, illumination arose within me with regards to things never heard before. This is the noble truth of the cessation of stress. This noble truth of the cessation of stress is to be directly experienced. Those two lines, within me and directly experienced, points to the experiential nature of the Dhamma, and that it's not something that is imposed on us by some outside agency or grand spiritual system of behavior modification. This noble truth of the cessation of stress has been directly experienced. Vision arose, insight arose, discernment arose, knowledge arose, illumination arose within me with regards to things never heard before. This is the noble truth of the way of practice leading to the cessation of stress. This noble truth of the way of practice leading to the cessation of stress is to be developed. This noble truth of the way of practice leading to the cessation of stress has been developed. And friends, as long as my knowledge and vision concerning these four noble truths as they have come to be was not pure, I did not claim to have rightly self-awakened. Such an important line. How do we know we're not awakened yet? When we don't have the knowledge and vision concerning these four noble truths. How do we awaken? We develop vision and knowledge of these four noble truths. There's absolutely no ambiguity in there, is there? It's clear. Now he's teaching his friends how to do this. This is the task to accomplish. Knowledge of four noble truths. But as soon as my knowledge and vision concerning these four noble truths, as they have come to be, was truly pure, then I did claim to be rightly self-awakened. And why not? You are. Now again, he's teaching these folks to do the same, and those same teachings are, he's teaching us to do the same thing, to become rightly self-awakened ones. Knowledge and vision arose in me unprovoked is my release. Unprovoked is another way of saying unconditioned is my release. There's nothing provoking it except what is occurring within me. Again, there's no outside agency or system working upon me. Unprovoked is my release. This is the last birth. There is now no further becoming. And we know from dependent origination, there is now no further becoming ignorant. Because it's pure. There's nothing left. There's no defilement left within an awakened human being's mind for further becoming. It's simply an ongoing process of pure mindfulness. And of course, the Buddha lived for 45 more years, living what I claim, I think, is the most effective and important human life ever lived. Because everything that followed, if followed correctly, leads to human awakening. This is what the Buddha said. Gratified, the group of five friends were delighted at his words. And while this explanation was being given, there arose in Kandana the understanding. All conditioned things that arise are subject to cessation. Then the Buddha exclaimed, so you really know, Kandana, you really know. You are now Anakandana, the one who understands. That's the end of the sutta. And so now you see how everything that the Buddha taught was taught in that context. I should say, don't you? But you do.
Yes.
And you see, David and I had such a wonderful talk this morning about context and how it is of primary singular importance in developing the Dhamma is understanding the context. And something as important as the Anapanasati Sutta is virtually useless and even probably damaging when you don't have the right context to apply something as important as that. So there's primary suttas and there's secondary suttas. What we're talking about, and these three suttas are primary suttas. And those secondary suttas are certainly no less important. They just need the proper context and in order to understand how to apply those. So, to some minds, hearing the Four Noble Truths is enough to awaken. To some of us, like the other four folks, me, and I would say some of you, except maybe David, we need a lot more of a situational understanding of how to apply this. And that's really what all the other suttas were for. And the Buddha understood this. This is why he kept teaching. And you'll see as we get into these next two suttas, the situations that arose that compelled him to give a certain sutta. And before I get in, and I'd like to do that now. I'd like to do the Anattalakkhana Sutta. But before I do that, does anybody have any questions about how this establishes the Dhamma? Because I think that's important.
It's not really a question, but for the first time, well, the words sort of, the action words or the task words of comprehend, abandon, experience, and develop were sort of jumping out there.
Yeah.
That's kind of along that. It's very clear and direct of you know, comprehending, developing the context of dukkha profoundly.
Yeah.
Abandoning, as we know what to do, and experiencing it then, and further developing. It's really nice how that's succinct like that.
And you put it exactly as it should be, or should be seen. We are given we develop specific skills to accomplish specific tasks. That's the Dhamma. The specific skills that we develop are concentration and proper mindfulness. And that supports the accomplishment of these tasks, the task of, that you just described, of understanding Four Noble Truths. That's the Dhamma. That the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, I love the word, is often called setting the wheel of truth in motion. Now, later schools claim that there's three wheels of truth. And I'm just saying that that you may come across that. The Buddha set one wheel of truth in motion, and everything was in that context. And this wheel has rolled into our present time. The wheel is rolled into this room. It is present at Cross River Meditation Center. It's present anytime anybody's referring to the suttas. David, did you have your hand up? Yeah, that's
so
fine.
In this sutta, he's saying, setting the goal, and then he's explaining how to reach the goal.
Yeah, that's it. And every teaching is exactly that in that context too. And if Diane asked me the other day that, how come you don't always explain the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path because every sutta refers to that? Well, you think my classes are long now if I started doing that. But that would be too redundant, because it's important that we push ourselves a little bit to remember the context and to apply it in the context. And again, I think it would just be incredibly boring too if I started every class with this. But again, it's important to have the context. And as the progression of our Sangha and our retreats has developed, again, I couldn't have taught the Anapanasati Sutta two retreats ago. I might have been able to last retreat. And I certainly couldn't have done it on our first retreat. But now, as a Sangha, we're ready to hear it. And again, David, really, would you talk a little bit about that? Because you expressed it so beautifully this morning. About how important the context was for you to understand the Anapanasati Sutta, but once you had it, you could.
I mean, once you brought up the thought, the concept of context, anyway, I took the approach, it was very intellectualized. I learned the list, I learned the words, and then I heard the first three discourses, and then it was a perfect timing, kind of like what Laura said yesterday, that if it had come a month earlier, the Anapanasati Sutta wouldn't have meant anything to me. But because it was in the right context, it dovetailed everything I learned and understood, and then it became experiential. I was able to sit and experience it, and even though I still study, it's now shifted to living it. And like Ron said a few weeks ago, well, maybe a month ago, that it's you just become, and you don't have to work so hard at these things that are so simple, but you have to untangle yourself. So context was everything.
Thank you. So I waited all these years for David to show up at our Sangha, and then I could teach it.
It also speaks to right effort.
Exactly, yes.
The reason David can speak about a compressed timeline of his experience with the Dhamma is a great deal of effort.
Yeah.
Put into it and prioritization in his life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that the fruits of that.
Yeah.
And that's it. And again, excuse me for holding you up as an example, but that's the, but we're all that example, aren't we?
Well, it's just I know you have to experience the seven factors. You have to be mindful before you can be, you know, investigate and so on. But there is just a element of joy that gives you energy to investigate.
Yeah.
And the goals later of, you can see them. You know, so you don't get tired, you don't get bored, you don't get
distracted.
You don't take a day off. Why would you want to take a day off?
Yeah. Yeah, that joyful enthusiasm or joyful engagement with the Dhamma is
inspiring.
But at some point it becomes necessary to continue, or else then the Dhamma practice is just another practice of drudgery. You know, at some point we make that shift when we realize the effectiveness of this Dhamma, and it's not something we can cultivate it, but it's not something we can pull out of thin air. There has to be a foundation for joyful enthusiasm, or it's just like anything else. It doesn't persist, it doesn't last. But when it's grounded in the Dhamma, it's what carries us along. You know, and it's really what brought us all here and allows us to commit to something like spending 4 days listening to endless Dhamma talks. And by the way, I just decided we've had enough this morning, I think.
We're spending the time to attend the Sangha.
Yes. And again, we're so fortunate to Kevin is responding to me, needling him about coming to class more often. But, it is. I only say that because I know your commitment to the Dhamma.
It's true. I mean, it just goes along with what you just said. I mean, that's, you know, if you don't have all the three jewels, you have two of them. It's that extra push, that enthusiasm comes from all of you and our Sangha. So
yeah.
I've been missing it from a personal level. So looking forward to getting that going.
Yeah, the three jewels are taught for that same reason. I wasn't kidding. I would be happy to teach the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta right now, but I really feel like maybe an hour off would be more auspicious. But you tell me.
Well, I have a question unrelated to that question.
Please.
Is the sutta on dependent origination a primary or secondary?
Primary. In fact, I would say it's the
the
most primary. Ultra super.
That sutta, the retreat we had on that, I feel like for me was like the most intellectual experience of the Dhamma, and really like studying that and trying to understand all the different steps on that cycle, and then from that being able to then investigate and have the experience.
Yeah, unless you have an understanding, and human beings learn intellectually first, but unless you have somewhat of an experiential understanding of dependent origination, even the Four Noble Truths won't make a whole lot of sense, but you need those two together. And again, it's really what has, the reason why the Buddhist teachings haven't persisted primarily is because the alterations and the accommodations and the embellishments made to the Paticca-samuppada Sutta, which is now often presented. Dependent origination is often presented as and called dependent co-arising, which teaches the interdependence and interconnectedness and interbeing of all things. Well, we have read it. Is there anything in there about interdependence and dependence is two different things, isn't it? Two completely different things, even though there's a common word.
But I find it the hardest one, I found it the hardest one to penetrate and to integrate. It's a bit of a slog. And it took a lot of repetition before it finally started to settle. I still can't pinpoint the time when it finally started to settle in. Like, oh yeah, this is working. This is how it is. This is how you get from A to B to C to D to suffering.
Yeah. When Ananda declared to the Buddha, I got dependent origination, the Buddha knew he didn't. And he said, no, you don't. He says, dependent origination is broad and vast and almost impenetrable. You're basically saying you're fooling yourself.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously the Buddha could tell just by his conversation. And you know, one of the reasons why I don't do it on retreats often, but we're doing it naturally. One of the reasons why I go around the room at each class is because it's from the questions you ask and the comments you make that I understand as a Sangha what needs to be taught. And there's no other way to, how else would I know, that leads up to where these three suttas came up in the next one, the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta. the Buddha taught them because he was keenly listening to what the growing Sangha was talking about in their free time. And one of the discussions that, the initial discussions that spiritual seekers would naturally have at that time is, well, what does this guy think about not self? Because that was a common underlying theme in the Vedas and later the Upanishads, was that there's no such thing as a self, period. And then the speculative question then has to fill in, well, then what is it? And that leads to all the foolish questions. So the Buddha knew that, and then he immediately taught the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta that I keep saying. Do you want me to teach it now, or do we want to wait? Really, I if whatever you decide is fine with me. It's 11 o'clock, so we could have an hour break. I guess we've had kind of a busy morning so far, haven't we? But it's up to you. So you have to make a decision, or I'll leave it up to Matt, because Matt is the one that makes the executive decisions around here. So let's.
For a talk on myself.
Really? Thank you. Is that okay with you, sir? Okay. It's probably going to take us right up to lunchtime, but that's okay with me.
Buckle up.
So again, just to put ourselves in the right setting, because it's exactly the same now. Well, not exactly the same. It's not quite as dusty here as it was in northern India at the time. But everything else really is the same. We're people looking for understanding. And listen closely, because the Buddha is going to speak. On one occasion, the Buddha was staying at Benares in the deer park at Isipatana. Again, the setting. This is about a month. Again, a little bit of speculation, but because of the pacing of these first three suttas, it's reasonable to assume this is about a month after the Buddha's teaching, the first teaching. On one occasion, the Buddha was staying at Benares in the deer park at Isipatana. There he addressed a group of five bhikkhus, still. Bhikkhus, form is not self. Were form self, then this form would not lead to suffering. And one could have it be any form desired and stress-free, just by an act. If we owned it, we have control over it. That's the point the Buddha's making. If it's truly a self, then we would have complete control over it. If we don't, it's not. Since form is not self, it leads to suffering, and none can have it be any form desired and stress-free. I need to increase the font a little bit so I can see it. There you go. Bhikkhus, feeling is not self. As perceptions are not self and fabrications are not self, and it's referring to five clinging aggregates. Consciousness is not self. If these aggregates were self, they would not lead to suffering, and one could direct these aggregates as one wished. Since these are not self, they can only lead to suffering, and no one can have these aggregates be as they wish. Bhikkhus, how do you perceive this? Is form permanent or impermanent? The five replied, impermanent, venerable sir. So, venerable sir?
I would have said about the back thing.
I know I blew it.
Okay, so is he explaining the Four Noble Truths here? Is he explaining how the mind is and trying to get to that First Noble Truth?
Yes. It's a direct teaching on how to develop understanding of Four Noble Truths. And now so the Four Noble Truths speak to impermanence, the environment that we're all in a general way I'm talking, but it's also very specific that it gets to the path. And the second mark of existence is a not self characteristic, which he's finding is now the confusing aspect in these five bhikkhus' minds. And so he's teaching how to understand, in the context of 2600 years ago, where there was just as much confusion about not self and non self. The reason why I don't call it the non self characteristic is because that's misleading. The Buddha is saying that these five clinging aggregates, what we call anatta, does not constitute a self. It's not a self. The five clinging aggregates, even though we use them to describe a self to ourselves by clinging, do not constitute a self. They're not a self. How do we know they're not a self? Because we can't control them at all. They're they arise and pass away of their own volition, impacted by the way we view them.
So it ties them directly to permanence and to suffering. So
yes.
Here there's a three together.
And you see the connection.
The context is understand this.
Yes.
See this so that you can be released.
Yes.
That's the context.
That's the context. Yes.
Because
see?
I hear, this is like, I don't even know how many times have I heard this now? Many.
Yeah.
So, but every, it's like, yeah, okay, yeah, I get that. Yeah, okay, yeah. Move on.
Yeah.
That's what's happening inside. Yeah. So when you're talking, now you're talking about context, I'm like, really having to concentrate to remember the context.
So
this isn't about me getting what those words are. It's about remembering what the Buddha's point is here.
Yes.
He's trying to make you focus on understanding that stress is a construct of your mind. And
yes.
Understanding how the mind really works so that you can release yourself from the stress.
And what's experiencing impermanence and suffering? Anatta.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The wrong view of anatta, again, could be the same thing as saying wrong views. It could be the same as saying ignorance. It's all part and parcel of the same package of suffering. You could say that the not self characteristic is dukkha, even though
right,
it's and you could say that impermanence is dukkha. It can't you,
mm-hmm.
especially in a misunderstanding. That's why when Kandana declared that all conditioned things that arise are subject to cessation, the Buddha knew that he got it, because he's referring to that whole, the whole package of misunderstanding. And now Kandana understands all conditioned things, including the conditioned thinking that form is self, feelings are self, perceptions are self, fabrications are. That's all conditioned thinking. Conditioned by what?
Wrong view.
Mm-hmm.
Ignorance, same thing.
By the way, I was not ready to move on because I was like stuck in trying to understand context.
Again,
thank
so
you all for that.
Well, and thank you for bringing it up. This is
yeah.
And by really, by the question, you allowed us to all fresh it out a little bit more.
Yeah.
This is how it works. And we could not do this if you didn't have an understanding of the Dhamma. And none of us could do. None of us could be supportive of each other. Again, that's how a sangha works. It's how the Dhamma works, by the way.
Yeah.
It's how. It's why there's three refuges. You can't do it with just two.
I look upon it as, this is how I think of myself. This is
the
framework I think of myself.
That's as clear as you can put it.
Which is wrong view. And which is my homework to work on breaking down that image that I have of myself.
Yeah.
That's my homework.
Yeah. And is it okay to have wrong view then?
Mm-hmm.
Is it okay?
Is it acceptable?
Well, in a forgiving way for myself.
Yes, that's the point. That's exactly the point. Yes, we should get, and we should all forgive ourselves for having wrong view.
Yes, we're born that way.
We
don't know any different.
We could get into that speculative thing. Well, how did I fall into wrong view? You can't. Mm-hmm. Ignorance has no beginning. It's just here.
And even if it had a beginning.
Who cares?
And it may arise again. It may
come
up against it.
Right. Well, as the Buddha teaches in the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, unless it's pure. Until it was pure, I did not declare that I was a rightly self-awakened one. We can kid ourselves, can't we? I've been meditating for 30 years. I'm awakened. I've known people that were severely deluded, and this is just it's not a put-down, it's an observation, that claim to be rightly self-awakened one. Ram had a direct, I'm sorry, am I putting you in a position you don't want to be in?
No. I've had several of those people around me who find me say, either I'm awakened or I'm in this level of awakening. There's another good one.
There's no levels, folks. It's just either are you or not.
And most of my whole previous so-called spiritual path was just rife with this speculation about, who's enlightened? Is he enlightened?
Yeah.
And distractions.
It is.
That game goes on forever.
Possibly.
It depends on that, so.
And it is. And who cares if I don't? Who cares if Kevin's awakened? I want to find out that I am.
Uh-huh.
That's the and that, and again, that's why the Buddha held himself out, and not in a completely honest way, that he's just a guy, he's just another human being. So to be an example that anyone can do this. There was always a constant push within the Buddha Sangha to elevate him above just a simple teacher. And he never would accept it. He went out every day with his little bowl and his clothes made out of rags, his robes made out of rags, to make the point. Kasapa, when I teach that, you'll see that was the same thing.
And that's... But you can see the anatta, like if I can say, okay, Kevin is enlightened, that's the end of the Me Too that I can go through to get to Kevin, and I can just control everything to Kevin, then I will be enlightened. It's wrong.
Yes and no. But
yeah.
Well, it depends what your intention is. To recognize an awakened human being, like the five folks did, then it's reasonable to want to know what they have, to actually follow them.
To listen to them.
Awesome.
But you better be sure.
Using
Ram as an example, but too many examples of spiritual, so-called spiritual leaders that had great charisma but have no understanding and literally led people to hell. Whether in a real sense or in a figurative sense, just in their minds through the confusion that they wrought. One of the, and I will not mention his name, if you want to know who I'm talking about, you ask me later and I will mention who it is. But one of the great spiritual teachers of our time, still present if you want to believe certain beliefs, was simply a magician. He was a great magician, probably the greatest magician we've ever had, greater than Houdini or some of the modern ones. But he was simply a magician. He could perform miracles in front of you. He had nothing else to really teach except miracles. And because of that, because he was such an impressive magician, he had thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of followers to this day. We so want to be distracted.
Mm-hmm.
And if something comes along that can distract us and we can put the spiritual or religious label on it, it's gonna sell.
Yeah.
It's a really good business.
Ties the whole so-called spiritual and religious world together. It's this desperate wish for people to see miracles.
Yes, and that's not, and I'm not condemning, I know it sounds like it, and it's so hard for me to not sound like that, but I'm not condemning any of that. But like I was saying to Ram last night, to me, I guess this is going to sound, maybe it was David, this is going to sound denigrating, but to me it's just putting it in perspective. I have nothing wrong with engaging in any type of religious practice except maybe the severe stuff that leads to violence. No religion has been free of that, unfortunately, even modern Buddhism. But to me, it's just another activity of like bowling on Thursday night. There's nothing wrong with bowling on Thursday night. It's not going to deliver you awakening, but it can be a pleasant abiding, can't it?
Right.
Much like going to church on Sunday. It can be a pleasant abiding. Nice
Sunday,
songs. And
looking for
them. Well, there's the problem. But again, there's nothing wrong with it. And the real problem is conflating religion with what an awakened human being taught, with what the Tao is. It's another good example of it. It's not religion, and it's not really modern spirituality, but it is true spirituality in that it inspires us to find out who we are. What is more important? So religion has its place in the world. How do I know that it has its place in the world?
Because it's there.
Because it's in the world. So it has a place. This is not that. And again, this is as you listen to the Buddha's words, he's saying this in a mostly indirect way until he runs into the likes of Vajragoda and Malankaputta, etc. Then he's very clear about the difference between what he's teaching and what he's not.
But John, also, in conjunction with what Jennifer was saying, of taking, you know, who she is, and then the Me Too going directly to Kevin, and where Kevin is, and sort of judging yourself against that, where it's specifically in the Dhamma that it is a completely individual journey for each person
Yes.
who goes through this process.
Yes.
So there's no room for judgment, mm-hmm. because you're bringing to it what you're bringing to it.
Yes, and wisdom would say there's no room for comparison either.
Exactly.
That's a difficult trap.
And that's something in any form of life, but
within the Sangha, it can get to the debilitating level when we, within the Sangha, we're comparing ourselves to someone else who's seemingly progressing faster than we are, because we're such an intimate group that can easily arise. And that's not wrong. Why is it not wrong? Because it's present and it does occur. And that's why, again, when people that are coming that have never been to our group before and they want to know what to expect, really the only thing I said is you'll find a warm and welcoming Sangha, because that's what we are. This is what's unique about this group, what the Buddha would say is rare in the world. We allow each other to be who we are at whatever level. There's no hierarchy. There's no room for advanced practitioners within Cross River Meditation Center. And the reason why is because there was no room in the original Sangha. And how could there be? Awakening is the most ordinary thing in the world. It's the most human thing. In fact, maybe I'm given to a little hyperbole. It's the only human thing that there is in the world, is awakening. I'm sorry, Mary.
No, I was interrupting you. And we go through shifts, right? So even on this retreat, anyone, or other retreats, anyone can have a day or a couple of days that, are the awareness has expanded. And then we might go through 3 weeks from then, a time frame where we came up against something and it's not coming back to us as easily. I'm just saying that it's not cyclical or anything like that. It just is, like you said, it's not hierarchical. In my experience, you don't build on it and it's not like you go backwards either. Mm-hmm. It's just you continue to experience life and you leverage, or you're more skillful. That's simplifying it too, but you're
skillful
on some days than other days, mm-hmm. or something like that's like a representative phrase, but it would be wrong to get disappointed in yourself if you thought you had made so much progress and then you find yourself one day struggling in there. Wow, I thought I had left this behind, yeah. and all that.
Yeah. That's a self-referential view, isn't it? It's an extreme self-referential mm-hmm. view. I'm sorry I interrupted you.
No, that's what I had to say.
And so, what's the primary instruction you hear from me? Be gentle with yourself. Because that's a key. It's a key to the Dhamma, but it's also a key to life, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And why not? I mentioned it wrong. I think I've talked to all of you, so I get a little confused about what I'm saying to who. For at least 2 years now, I've been kind of writing off and on this article that explains dukkha in the fashion of we are all stuck in self-loathing. The world is stuck in self-loathing. But it's the subtleties of how that manifests in the world are difficult to thresh out because it's so embedded in us. But that's another way of saying a misunderstanding of self, because it results in that type of self-loathing, which leads into competition even within a well-focused Sangha. How come that person's been here for 3 weeks and they're so much more advanced than I am? Well, you don't know that, do you? Nobody can know that.
Mm-hmm. Which is why it's just, humor in the Sangha is so important.
Well, yeah, it is, that's right. So to look at the absurdity of this, eye-making is the most absurd and laughable thing we can do. Although it has some pretty awful consequences at times, Kevin.
One thing, just how Jen was sort of working through her expression of that, just struck me as the way that the Dhamma and Suttas were recounted, because it was recounted, as you've said, with that type of exact procedure. They went, well, this is how it was, but, well, it was a little bit like this, and that's just amazing that the Dhamma is that preserved, and yeah. the same technique and the same process is happening here, right here.
Right here.
Right within
and there's
this.
No gaps in it.
Nothing.
No.
There's nothing left for speculation. Yes, it is incredible. And then, you know, one guy figured it out, a rightly self-awakened one, and he showed us, he taught us, and he's teaching us right now that we can do exactly the same thing. That they persist through time is the reason why they're called noble truths.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, that's not something the Buddha ever really... The most of the translators will say that they were never really called noble truths. That's an epithet that's been given them to simply describe the timeless nature like the Buddha described them as being.
He uses the word Arya in lots of different settings.
Yes, but even well, you know how the Pali language is.
Mm.
It depends on the setting. And it very well may be that he meant noble. But most scholars, I have a cousin, his name is Carl Olson. He's a professor of Eastern religions. And he's recognized as one of the real knowledgeable people. And I ran into cousin Carl at a funeral a couple years ago, eager to talk to him. And I wanted to talk to him about his meditation practice. I don't meditate, why would I meditate? He had a great, extensive scholarly knowledge of all types of Buddhism, but it had no real effect on me. Why was I going there? I don't remember. And so we had that talk, and he basically said this, but I heard it from I read it from some of Richard Gombrich's writing. By the way, Richard Gombrich is an excellent resource for understanding the genesis of Buddhism during the Buddhist time. He wrote some excellent books.
What's the name of him?
Richard Gombrich. I think I have
Gombrich.
Links. Gombrich. Richard. I think there's links on the website. If not, I promise I'll put them up this week. So it seems that as we've seen the facility of the four truths, that we've given the epithet of, they're noble truths. They relate to what the Buddha said. This is a timeless path, meaning that it persists throughout time. Again, noble is in reference to royal families that pass their nobility from one generation to the next,
mm-hmm.
to the next,
mm-hmm.
as all noble families, hoping to last forever, but none of them do, because even that is impermanent,
mm-hmm.
except these four noble truths. You know, they're just as relevant today.
And we have a noble wedding going on today.
Oh, we do?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Isn't the wedding today?
Oh, I didn't know that.
I turned down my invitation.
You turned down your invitation? So you could be here. That's
yes.
So nice.
So you could be here.
That was really
I turned down my invitation.
Yeah, it is. You know, this is something I would say tomorrow, and I probably will. But think about this. I'm going to say that.
Okay, good.
Think about our retreat. How different it would be if just one of you weren't here. It would not be the same thing. And it's because of the contribution we're all making to this retreat. And I'm not saying it wouldn't be an effective retreat, but it certainly wouldn't be as effective as it's going to be for each and every one of us. The Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. And again, I keep saying, we are so fortunate what has developed here. A lot of it has to do with this guy, too.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Now, is what is impermanent, painful, or pleasant? Pardon?
Sorry. She has two. Is getting married.
Sorry. Harry.
Let me go back one. You know, let me just check something. All right, we're not. It'd be foolish to try to finish this before lunchtime. So I am just going to go a little bit further, and then we'll continue it tonight. And there'll be plenty of time. There is another brief sutta that I do want to get to because it relates to something that Lorna brought up. So we may do three suttas tonight, or we may just do the fire discourse tomorrow. We'll see what happens. What's today? Saturday, right? Yeah. Okay. I thought the wedding was yesterday.
I think it was in the middle of the night for us, wasn't it?
Yeah. Anyway.
Some royal wedding.
Sorry.
Noble.
Oh,
nobility.
Oh. I thought you were talking, I don't know why, I made the connection to some of Maura's friends, Padma and Elaine.
No.
Myrna is,
no.
is
yes.
They got married yesterday.
Oh, no.
I don't know why I just made the connection. Pardon me?
Is that why she's not here?
Yeah.
One of the reasons.
Okay.
Yeah, so
the
royal,
wedding.
Yeah,
so we're talking, yeah. Very confused.
You got invited to the royal wedding?
That's
is that why you were coming here? Yes, I'm impressed.
That
you came.
Song
you,
of
really.
Humor, John. That was song of humor.
But it's true. She wasn't.
Bhikkhus, how do you perceive this? Is form permanent or impermanent?
Impermanent.
Now, is what is impermanent painful or pleasant, Venerable Sangha? Painful, Venerable Sir. Now, is what is impermanent, what is painful, since subject to, painful since it's subject to change, is this fit to be regarded as this is mine, this is me, this is myself?
No.
What's that question or that thought? Is feeling permanent or impermanent? Is perception permanent or impermanent? Are fabrications permanent or impermanent? Is consciousness permanent or impermanent?
All are
permanent. Noble teacher.
Watch the net.
Yeah. Now, is what is impermanent, what is painful, since it's subject to change, is this fit to be regarded as this is mine, this is I, this is myself?
No.
You can leave the Venerable Sir out, because my head is swelling. So bhikkhus, any kind of form whatever, whether past, future, or presently arisen, whether gross or subtle, whether in oneself or external, internal, external, remember the references to the other suttas, whether inferior or superior, notice my reference to the suttas, whether far or near, must with right understanding how it actually is, be regarded as this is not mine, this is not I, this is not myself. The one thought. And so it follows that any kind of feeling whatever, one of the aggregates, any kind of perception, any kind of determination, assumption, fabrication, any kind of consciousness whatever, whether past, future, or present, or presently arisen, whether gross or subtle, whether in oneself or external, whether inferior or superior, whether far or near, must, with right understanding how it actually is, be regarded as this is not mine, this is not I, this is not myself. Anytime any of the aggregates are arisen in our life and we find ourselves stuck in them, to remind ourselves, this is not me, this is not mine, this is not myself. Anytime we feel ourselves stuck in the world, Lorna asked, that this is what the other sutta that I might get to, what happens when I'm just so stuck in it? If we can, at that moment, to remind ourselves, this is not me, this is not myself, this is not who I am. And if in that moment, we will start depersonalizing whatever it might be. And we should get in the habit of doing this not only when our minds are agitated by anger or frustration or fear, but the profound teaching is when it feels like everything is going my way. Wait a minute, there's danger in that. This is not me, this is not mine. It's okay to acknowledge that I'm fortunate enough to have this experience, but then you should remind yourself when you're not feeling so wonderful how fortunate it is to have those experiences. Because that's a mind of equanimity. Lorna.
I think when you read down those and study them individually, you can see the root of them is I making.
Yeah, In response to that question, again, this would be a good sutta to read when we're really stuck in it and we can't. Meditation's not working. Nothing's working.
Mm-hmm.
Read this sutta. Or read any of the first three suttas, mm-hmm. Or read any sutta. But this would be a good one. Bhikkhus, when a noble follower who has heard the truth seen in this way, they find estrangement with form. What a good word to use. Of course, again, a translation from the Pali, but I think this is Tanisero's translation. It's the perfect English word, because what estrangement means, it means that we have no understanding. It's something foreign to us. It's strange to us. Now something that was so intimate that it consumed our life, clinging to form, feeling, perceptions, now it's strange to me. I don't understand it because it's not part of me anymore.
It's the opposite of self.
Yeah, not understanding it was the wrong word to use.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, it's a profound understanding that has become strange to me. because I'm no longer identifying with it.
Doesn't that go against what we've just learned about breathing in the body, though? It's hard.
It's just a point of reference.
Yes, but you're making a good point, because there can be a seeming contradiction or at least paradox there, couldn't there be? It has to do with intention and view.
Yeah.
And so, again, why I said this, using that example of the world's greatest teacher, or any thought can be a thought rooted in ignorance or rooted in wisdom. The same thought,
the same
appearance.
Mm-hmm.
What is the intention? What is the view behind it?
Yeah.
There's either that thought arising that this is me, or it's that awakening thought, this is not me.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the fine line. You know, that's Occam's razor. That's what we're walking each and every minute until we have the framework of the Dhamma. And then we can choose in each and every minute to depersonalize the experience that has no person in it. This is not me, this is not mine. This is the second teaching that the Buddha ever gave, and here we are learning it all over again. Again, the profundity of that is never lost on me. It's amazing.
The way we're thinking about the breath in the body, looking at our body, and the breathing in our body is just to focus our mind in the present moment.
With what's occurring.
With what's occurring, to bring our mind to the present moment. So that's the only useful way that we should, when we're thinking about us in the body, well, not us in the body, but our bodies.
Yes.
That's the only useful way we can think of it.
Yes.
Is to bring us into the present moment.
Yes, and not be distracted by the arising of self-identification to form, feeling, perceptions, etc.
Mm-hmm.
By noticing the impermanence of it,
mm-hmm.
by the training we get in meditation,
mm-hmm.
the immediacy of understanding impermanence, we can then take it and apply to something that seems so permanent because we've made it so.
Mm-hmm.
And then we can recognize, the form is impermanent. If it's impermanent, what did that awakened guy say? It can't be itself, can it?
It's just a thought.
And reasonable and logical thought, and we need to be a little bit careful to try and be too logical, because then we'll just get lost in the weeds. But logic within the framework of the context of the Dhamma shows that form can't be itself, can it? How could it? It's ever-changing, meaning a permanent substantial self. I can't identify. There's no possible way that I can identify myself successfully or meaningfully as saying, this is me. Because as soon as I say that, it's not, is it? It's a new me. Something different, something has changed that is beyond my control. And so another reason why I was hoping to teach the Vitakasadana Sutta, in that sutta the Buddha teaches that we gain control of our thinking. Guess what? That's the only thing that we can gain control of. That's the only place that we can establish the reference of what's occurring in our life as it unfolds. But it's not a self-reference anymore. Because we've developed true mindfulness. True mindfulness is the ability to think what we want to think, when we want to think it. Another way of saying that, it's thinking what's appropriate to what's occurring. Notice the Buddha's teachings, how every one of them is appropriate to what's occurring in front of him.
That's really clicking in for me now, because even when I hear this, and I'm listening to it as a student to try to understand stress versus listening to it as a historical event where he's explaining to other people who are at a certain place along the path or whatever. The context is helping, because I feel like focusing on not, you know, feelings arise, thoughts arise, fabrications arise. After practicing for as long as we all have, at saying that's not me, it starts to kind of not be helpful anymore, and I have to start thinking about it as it's
becomes too
irrelevant. It's not happening now. It's not part of this experience. just in your mind. It's not, you know, it's like there's more to it that I want to all, for it to all be in there, but it's not. I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does make sense.
Yes,
so a grasping mind wants more to be there, and that
right.
even with the most profound teachings of all time, we do it, don't we? And that's why the adaptations and accommodations have been made, because these great teachings aren't enough.
Yeah.
They weren't enough for people during the Buddha's time.
Mm.
There was a great push for some people to make it something else.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It was what motivated the Mahasanghikas to start a completely different Buddhist religion. I wish I could remember the gentleman's name, and I will. It was an older man, but not an elder. He was just kind of beginning with. Maybe he was around for a couple of years. When he heard that the Buddha died, he rejoiced because he said, now we can practice the way we really want to.
Mm-hmm.
We don't got that old
yes.
fool telling us what to do.
And
that's part of the Mahakasapa story too.
Right.
He was what?
He was right. You can now practice because
oh yeah,
not the way you want to.
Yep.
Because the Buddha wouldn't be there putting him right
yep.
in to tell him he's in wrong view.
Yeah, and he wanted to.
And
he wanted to have a Dhamma practice
that is wrong.
Yes, he wanted to maintain his views within a system that is designed to recognize
yes.
and abandon those wrong views.
We want to stay in wrong views.
And that's a really painful place to be, isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah.
Trying to reconcile that.
Yeah, it's double Dutch.
Yeah.
Yeah. I know what I mean, but it's double Dutch.
And because we're stuck in the feedback loop. That type of thing seems reasonable even with a Buddha teaching in front of you.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's my view. I need my view. The Anuradha Sutta is similar to that too, and in the other, the Vajragotas, etc. In my mind, I've decided that the Dhamma should be this way. And if the Buddha says it, it's not, I'm leaving the Sangha. Of course, he learned very quickly when the Buddha was patient and direct with him. You know, remember, just a few weeks ago, we went through it. The Buddha kind of nailed him between the eyes, didn't he? But he did it out of great compassion, married with great wisdom. So, it's 20 up. Let me just finish this list and then we'll continue this tonight. They find estrangement in form. They find estrangement in feeling. They find estrangement in perception. They find estrangement in determinations or fabrications. They find estrangement in consciousness. When they find estrangement, passion fades out. It's simply that way. When our aggregates become strange to us, when we're no longer identified to them, there's nothing else to do. They simply fade away. With the fading of passion, they are liberated. When liberated, there is knowledge that they are liberated. We know it. We've had the direct experience of it. They understand birth is exhausted. The integrated life, often translated as the holy life, the integrated life, and the reason why I use the word is meaning that it's integrated with the Eightfold Path. The integrated life has been lived out. What can be done is done. What can be done is done. Of this, there is no more beyond. Relating to there's nothing to add to this. Avoid the need to make it more than it is, because guess what, folks? Talking as a Buddha, I'm an awakened one. I know better. Just do this. That's enough for today,
very
for this
helpful.
Morning.
Thank you, John.
Very helpful.
Thank you,
yeah.
John.
And that really, that's almost the end of the sutta anyway. So we'll do the fire discourse tonight. The fire discourse is on what to do, how to subdue the passions. And you can see now how it just follows naturally from this. And that was given about a month later. But I think I am going to use a short sutta to introduce that tonight. And in an afternoon, this is the remarkable nature of our retreats, and I will take a little bit of credit for that. We will experience in a short day, in the proper context, the Buddha's three most important suttas. These are often called the cardinal discourses, to put the importance of these three suttas. We've just had two of them in this morning. So I am going to set that record, I think, today.
Can you just
clear it up? It's an auspicious day.
The program from this for this afternoon?
I think we're going to go out and get a keg, aren't we?
There's a keg.
That's a conditioned thought from an old drunk, isn't it? I'll let Matt answer the question because he's
maybe
more or less.
County, too. Yeah, New York is funny.
Matt has this afternoon schedule.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.